Check session number 17826, reel 1.
This is an interview with Mr. Bill Bedford at Brooklands Museum on Wednesday the 12th of July 1989.
Okay, could you sort of start off really with your beginnings, where you came from and the first jobs you did and how you first came to be flying?
Yeah. Well, it's a good start to the day anyway, Rodney, to walk in through the gates and see a beautiful hunter to welcome me as I arrived here today, and also to see the jet two-seater Harrier GVTOL in the hangar, so that ought to be a good omen for our talk anyway. But my beginning really was a modest one. I was the youngest of a family of five, and I was born on the 18th of November 1920. My father was killed in a motorbike accident when I was about 5 years old, so my mother had the job of raising the family of two boys and three girls. So whilst we were extremely well looked after as far as affection and consideration and that type of thing and family life, the economy was a little bit fragile, to say the best of it, which necessitated, of course, my mother taking in lodgers, and also we acted as an agent for pork pies and sausages from Bracknell, which I used to deliver and take orders for in my spare time, as well as being an assistant to a doctor. So it was really with that sort of background, combined with an unbelievably strictly religious background that I was brought up in, from a sect called the Brethren. Now, they're more exclusive than the exclusive Brethren. You almost had to have permission from higher authority to breathe. And, of course, things like the radio, the papers, smoking, dancing, women, except when you were married, were taboo. So, this sect, you see, considered themselves to be the only privileged ones who would go to heaven when their time on this earth disappeared. So that was an extraordinary background, really, to be brought up in. And somehow I sort of could not condone myself or allow myself to be, if you like, brainwashed into that. And so I became a rebel by not joining in the fellowship. And I was constantly prayed for during my life. Perhaps that's what kept me alive during my more hazardous activities as steeplejack, as fighter pilot, and then later as test pilot. Because I'm quite sure that a high-performance guardian angel certainly seemed to have kept a good eye on me during my life, without which I would never have made it. So, I suppose I was endowed with some qualities which perhaps could be summed up as tenacity, as not a brilliant brain, but a good coordination of eye and mind, and very much enjoying practical things and finding it damned hard work on the theoretical side of things. I was also lucky to have an extraordinarily considerate and kind mother. And from there, things developed. I didn't do terribly well at school, but I did well at sport. Academically, I was no very clever person, but I excelled in swimming and football, cricket, and all the other games that one was involved with in those days.
Where were you at school?
I went to, first of all, primary school called Rendell Street School, and then to Loughborough College School. And as the sands of time of my schooling were running out, I was very keen to become an automobile apprentice with Rolls-Royce at Derby. But they rejected me. And so I found myself joining a company called Blackburn Starling Limited in Nottingham as an apprentice to electrical, mechanical engineering and steeplejack work. And that started really the transition into engineering, and I had to work quite hard at night school, three nights a week, then three or four nights a week doing all the studying necessary to get my national certificate in electrical mechanical engineering and so forth. But this really was to stand me in good stead when I went to, when war broke out, and I applied to be a pilot in the Royal Air Force. Without that training, I would never have had the qualifications necessary for it. A few words on the apprenticeship. It started off with being a member of the cable gang at the Nottingham gun factory, which was producing ordnance for the army in a very big way, enormous great guns. And we were doing our company was doing the total rewiring of that factory. And this involved an enormous amount of heavy work in terms of lining the insides of trenches with the hooks to take the cables, and then hauling the cables into position, and then the distribution boxes being installed and wiring them up and taking them up over the girders and so forth. So it was hard work. My most important job was to be able to mash cans of tea for the cable gang. That's how it really all started off. So it was very intriguing last year to go and look at the Nottingham gun factory and find quite a lot of the things that I had been associated with in about 1936 still there, like the cables, the racks that we had hammered. Well, we hammered the rag bolts into the wall and attached the racks to them, then hauled the cables in and put the cables up. Those very same cables are still there, and some of the switch gear also. So, cutting a long story short, I spent probably about a year at the gun factory and then was involved with a whole variety of things, from wiring of factories and cinemas and houses. And mixed up with that came work in the office of Blackburn Starling on the drawing office side of things, and that brought me into touch with the mechanical side. The company made lots of components for the War Office, and so these had all to be carefully drawn out and monitored during their manufacture. And in like vein, on the steeplejack side of things, I found myself having to climb up chimneys about 200 feet high with just an iron ladder on the outside, and I found it was one of the most fearsome experiences of my life, because it was so totally insecure. There were no safety belts or anything. When one got to the top of the chimney was just very gently swaying from one side to another. Steeplejacks walk around the top without any fear whatsoever. I found myself initially walking around on two legs and 2 feet, because I was so paralyzed by it. We did the manufacture of new chimneys, the refurbishing of old chimneys, and a lot of specialized work in terms of putting lightning arresters on chimneys and lightning arresters on buildings. So that was the sort of steeplejack activity that I touched on in the fringe of my apprenticeship. And then after 3.5 years of that mixture of the manual work and the drawing office work and the steeplejack work, war broke out, and there was a recruiting office next door, and I applied to join the Royal Air Force, and in a short time I was at Uxbridge for medical at the RAF headquarters in London for them to see whether I had suitable material to be a pilot. And I was accepted by the Royal Air Force as a aircraftsman second class under training as a pilot, and went down to Newquay in Cornwall, where I started my initial training wing to be taught all about drill and Air Force law and generally get a feeling for what the Royal Air Force was all about. The Bergen Osterberg PT College was evacuated there, and at a dance I met a girl called Mary Averill, who I married just before going overseas in 1941, and by some extraordinary fate I'm still married to her, which is quite a remarkable thing. It's had its fair shares of ups and downs. And so After the initial training, I went up to Perth in Scotland to Scone to number 8 Elementary Flying Training School, which was civilian run. And there I was introduced to the famous Tiger Moth. And it didn't seem very long before the instructor got out and I was away feeling very exhilarated on my first solo with the aeroplane bounding along the grass and jumping into the air with great enthusiasm without the instructor in the back, and feeling that, you know, I had reached the pinnacles of success in aviation, particularly when I completed the circuit and landed the machine without breaking it.
How many hours did you take to go?
Oh, I didn't do anything very spectacular, I think, in terms of number of hours. I think it was something like eight or nine hours. And then I went down to Hillavington to the SFDS there on the Miles Master with the Kestrel engine. And, of course, that was a completely new generation of aeroplane. We looked in the cockpit with awe to see all the instruments and the selector levers for the undercarriage and flaps, and we thought, well, we're never really going to be able to master a thing like this. But
variable pitch prop as well, I suppose.
Yes. Radiator shutter control and so forth. It looked unbelievably complicated compared with the Tiger Moth, but like all these things in life, with a bit of instruction and guidance and a bit of luck, you gradually settle down to it. And one felt flying that aeroplane, you were flying the beginnings of what was a Spitfire or a Hurricane. And on the course we also had some Hurricane 1 aeroplanes, so that having gone solo on the Master, we were able to fly the very early Hurricane. And of course that was a feeling of immense pride to fly in the government's high-performance fighter aeroplane. It was rather like the government providing with a sports car in which to indulge.
Now, with the Hurricane, you couldn't be initiated by it with any duel. You had to get in, and it was solo from the first moment.
Yes, yeah.
Did you feel any apprehension of getting in this?
Yes, I think you do feel apprehension if you have any feeling at all about things and people, and you're doing something new for the first time, and there is a certain hazard with it. You really are your own worst enemy if you don't have some apprehension and consideration and the feeling of adrenaline going. But, I mean, the basics were the same. A powerful single-engined aeroplane that would swing on takeoff. So you'd had the training for that, really, on the Miles Master. And the visibility was just a little bit worse forward than on the Master. So, really, the interim step from the Master to the Hurricane was not a very large change. So we got that out of the way, and then it was an operational conversion unit with Hurricanes that I flew on. And after that, to a squadron in the Midlands, number 605, County of Warwick Squadron. And they were, at rather short notice, whistled off to go out to the Far East. A number of them were sunk, or their aircraft were sunk, and a number of the pilots were lost when one of the aircraft carriers was sunk, and quite a lot of the pilots finished up as prisoners of war. Because I wasn't up to a particularly high standard, I was transferred to 135 Squadron. This was in the Midlands at Honolly, and we had a very famous wing commander in charge by the name of Chota Carey, who I think was probably one of the top-scoring pilots in the Royal Air Force, but he was a sergeant pilot in the Battle of Britain. I think he had a DFM and bar, a DFC and bar, DSO and bar, which really wasn't bad going. And but he didn't quite get the same publicity, because at that time it seemed to be the pattern to give publicity to the commissioned people, but not the uncommissioned ones.
Like Ginger Lacey.
Yeah, he was a very similar person. And Chota Carey, of course, went out to the Far East and made quite a name for himself in the Japanese War. So I just settled down a little bit with number 605 Squadron. That would be in 1942. And then we were on our way to to an unknown destination. We went up to Scotland, and it was just before my going abroad that I got married. And we went on to a ship called the Durban Castle at Gourock to go to an unknown destination. And it was marvellous on board this ship because there was no rationing, and we could get unlimited quantities of bacon and eggs for half a crown a serving on the black market on the ship, beautiful rolls and butter, and it was an interesting experience, me to be leaving England for the first time. We finished up the west coast of Africa, and there on, I think it was Imperial Airways, we flew in comfortable stages to Cairo, where we waited for our long-range Hurricanes, which were being prepared at Kilo 8, which I think now is Heliopolis. So as a young man, it was fascinating to see the world opening up underneath you, to go through and see the natives in countries like, I suppose it was the Gold Coast and Kano, which I suppose was Nigeria. Kano then still part of Nigeria. It was still called Nigeria. It's hard to catch up and remember all the changes that took place.
When you crossed Africa to go to Heliopolis by Imperial Airways?
I think it was Imperial. It was one of the civil airlines.
Do you remember the airline you flew in? Was it?
No, I don't. I don't. It didn't make that impression on me at the time. I suppose I... No, I have got no record of that whatsoever. We had a couple of weeks in Cairo, and then we were on our way flying in easy stages out to Burma. So, I mean, we called it... And, of course, that's a fascinating thing to see the conditions that obtained there in the Middle East. I mean, there were vast areas of deserts and very primitive types of reception areas and air traffic control when you landed, to compare with what has happened now with the effect of oil and the development of so-called civilization in those parts. I remember very clearly landing at Habania in Iraq, and We'd had a long day, but of course you have limitless energies. And we were put up in a tent because there was no accommodation in the mess. And we went through the gates and hailed a taxi. Terrible, dilapidated taxi. By this time it was dark. And no road to Baghdad at all. The driver got out, looked at a star, aimed the car at the star across the desert, and we were on our way. And after a couple of hours or so, we arrived at Baghdad, had a look round, had some food, and the reverse happened on the journey back. Totally exhausted, I fell asleep, to be woken by an evil black face with a cutthroat razor poised to deliver the blow. And I thought my last minute had come. But apparently it was the normal practice to be shaved whilst you were in bed in that particular part of the world. So I survived that incident. I was welcomed by a cup of hot, sweet, smoky tea and a donut. That was our breakfast. And a lorry collected us. We were driven out to our aeroplanes. We put our parachute bag belongings in the gun panel and screwed the panel back on again. Started up. It was still dark. The flames from the...
These are flying Hurricanes, though, aren't
they? Yeah. Mm. Flames from the exhaust pipes were in evidence, shining cherry red. And, you know, by the time we'd sort of taxied out to the takeoff place with a line of stern on the Blenheim that was doing some navigation for us, the dawn had broken. That surprised me. So how... The rapidity of the change from night to day and the other end of the day from day to night. Abrupt discontinuity compared with what one was used to in Europe. Then easy stages through India, and then eventually we arrived at Mingaladon in Burma. And there the... I think there were the American-operated Tomahawks were operating there. They had the sponsorship, I think, of the Chinese government behind them. And, of course, already out there were a number of Hurricanes. And I remember the story told about Chota Keri when he arrived at mingled on, substantially ahead of the time that I got there. And these Americans, ADV, I think they were, AVG, AVG maybe they were called, American Volunteer Group, that's right. And they saw this hurricane arrive overhead, shut the throttle, and do a series of violent side-slip manoeuvres to touch down on the runway, and on the runway continue weaving from one side to the other, get onto the perimeter track, cut the engine some distance away from the dispersal, spin the aeroplane round until it went backwards to come to a stop exactly where Chota Carey had intended. And the Americans said, "That goddamn man's going to kill himself." They had no idea who he was. I spoke to Carey about this many years later, about his always this tendency to be flying with motion on under combat conditions. He was eventually the Rolls-Royce man in Canberra. And he said, well, in the early part of the war, there were three Ju-87s flying along in formation that I intercepted. He said one of them was jinking. I ignored him and I shot one down, had a go at the other one, and the one that was jinking escaped. And he said, to me, that was one of the most valuable lessons that I ever learnt. One, if you're always on the move, you're always conscious of the fact there might be something behind you and you're a difficult target to attack. Then you should adopt this policy all the time that you're operationally flying. And it saved his life later on.
When you say jinking, and this is just slight course alterations all the time.
Well, it is, by the jinking I mean, was an abrupt application of rudder to cause the aeroplane to sideslip one way and then sideslip the other way. Okay, you lose a bit in terms of your speed, but you gain in terms of your survivability. And at some many years later, Chittagong, Chota Carey went out to sea. We were going back into Burma at the time, having escaped once from the Japanese. We were going back in there with more equipment, more aircraft, and so on. Chota Carey went to have a look at Chittagong, arrived, got out of his aeroplane, and suddenly the air raid went. And he just had time to say, does this thing happen very often? Tore into his hurricane, jumped onto the wing, into the cockpit, started up, didn't do his straps up at all, and opened the throttle, and he was bounced by two Japanese Zeros. And he adopted this technique of flying low and massive angle of sideslip one way, massive angle of sideslip the other way. Disappeared through a gap between two palm trees. One of the Zeros hit the palm tree and he escaped from the other one. So it's just remarkably indicative of, you know, what that sort of defensive technique could do in terms of, and did do in terms, I mean, he was so far ahead of the average pilot, particularly someone like myself, who was a relative newcomer. Anyway, going back to where we were in Burma, I was involved in doing a number of escorts, imagine this, of Lysanders carrying bombs and Blenheims carrying bombs in a vain attempt to stop the Japanese coming into Burma. And of course, we were at the end of a pipeline when there was a pretty important war going on in Europe, so the logistic support, spares, and so on were extremely limited, as indeed were the manpower, and therefore there was no alternative but to move out of Burma and into India. As a junior member of the squadron, there wasn't even an airplane left for me, so I had to come out on a boat. So I didn't really play a particularly predominant part in the war in the air during my time in the Royal Air Force, and we went back to Dum Dum Aerodrome, where we used to get up at the crack of dawn each morning to do readiness. We were very limited in the very limited in the amount of flying that we were allowed to do because of the shortage of engines and the shortage of spares generally. So we were curtailed about 10 or 12 hours a month, and most of it was readiness, practice combat maneuvers, unsuccessfully trying to intercept Japanese reconnaissance aeroplanes that were flying over because the radar and other facilities were virtually negligible there. And Christmas Day of 1942 saw me going to do redness at Dum Dum Aerodrome, getting up very early in the morning, because we used to disperse our aeroplanes quite frequently at funny little camps called Dirty Dick, Dunster and Dunstable, little dispersed grass strips nearby. On this particular occasion, our aircraft were actually at Dum Dum, and I was in the station wagon with a whole gaggle of people. The driver, called Sergeant Brown, was drunk, and Sergeant Brown went round one corner on two wheels, and then we finished up on a paddy road, a road going through a paddy field, raised above the paddy field. We came to the next corner, right angle bend, and the thing rolled over, and two of us were thrown out. Sergeant Ford landed on his head and killed himself immediately, and I was thrown out, fractured my back, my pelvis, my kidney, put my arm out, got hit on the head and went slithering along a gravel-covered road and ended up in the ambulance. CO came along and said to me, "Don't worry, Goldney, you'll soon be all right." I mean, he even got my name wrong. And on the stretcher up there was poor old Sergeant Ford with his head bashed in. So that was a pretty dramatic start, really, to my experience. I was dangerously ill for about 3 to 4 weeks, and then gradually higher authority gave me a reprieve, and I finished up 4 months in hospital with plaster from my ankles upwards, and then had a further 4 months of rehabilitation, finishing up in the foothills of the Himalayas at a place called Chakrota. I mean, it was an absolutely beautiful part of the world, with peace and quiet and just convalescence facilities and a small service army camp there, and one walked and swam and played tennis and disappeared with... I never used to go on these long distances unless I had someone with me, and we'd walk on the mountain paths and do 15 or 20 miles. And I finished up at Delhi for my medical, sort of bronze like the colour of this table. And the board couldn't believe that I had survived this phenomenal accident. And I was very, very lucky, A, to survive, and B, not to be maimed, and C, to get back on flying again, which I did. I never had any trouble at all from that back or anything, with one exception. 10 years later, when I went for a medical, said, "Can't accept water like this." The kidney I damaged, the got stones in, it had to be removed. But, you know, apart from that, had no ill effects. So I rejoined the squadron then down at down at Bangalore, where we were converting Blenheim pilots onto Hurricanes. And we did quite a bit of this. Then we went down to Madras to get ourselves geared up prior to going down to Ceylon to convert onto the Thunderbolt. So the Thunderbolt emerged. There was no one to do the conversion course. We just got the pilot's notes, and away we went, and gradually built up confidence in this enormous great aeroplane, with which was very easy to land, but was rather sluggish compared with the Hurricane. It did have a turbo blower, so it kept its thrust at high altitude rather better than, or kept its power at high altitude rather better than the Hurricane did. It had a massive radial engine that took an enormous amount of punishment, and it had good long range, and I think at the time we had 0.5 machine guns on it, so it was down compared with what we'd been used to later on the Hurricane with the 20 millimeter guns that the...
I was going to ask you about the Hurricanes. I mean, when you flew them, it was mainly in the interceptor role, was it, as escorts?
I did one or two scrambles without seeing anything. I did a number of escorts of the Lysanders, in which all we had to contend with was anti-aircraft fire, and I personally didn't run into any Japanese aeroplanes.
And it's about the 8 Brownings that didn't the wing.
Yeah, yes, we had the 8 machine guns in those days.
And you
did I say 8?
8.
It was 6, wasn't it? 6 on each side, 12 machine guns. I think I'm right in saying that. Yeah.
I think the Mark 1 had 8, didn't it? Yeah. And the early Spitz had 8, didn't it?
Yes, yes. I think memory is a bad thing, but I'm quite...
The four cannon version.
I flew the 420 millimeter cannon, but I didn't fly the tank buster one with the two enormous great big cannons that you had to achieve firing speed before you fired your guns. So they used to say, anyway, going back to the Thunderbolt, which we had mixed feelings about, really. I mean, but, you know, it had advantages of range, it had advantages of speed, but it just did not have the manoeuvrability that the Hurricane had. So in terms of outfighting the MiGs, you had to be, extremely careful, and the tactics had to be to dive on the enemy aircraft, break and get the hell out of it